Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Last week, Malcolm Turnbull acted swiftly, some said too hastily, to revelations of abuse in the Northern Territory's Don Dale Youth Detention Facility. He announced a royal commission would be set up and a commissioner was quickly appointed, but it turned out to be a bumpy start. Brian Martin, the commissioner chosen by Malcolm Turnbull and George Brandis to lead the inquiry into the corrections and child protection systems in the Northern Territory, decided over the weekend that he would quit the post. He said criticisms of him on various grounds could undermine the effectiveness of the commission. So now two new commissioners have been appointed. Margaret White is a former Queensland judge, and Mick Gooder has been the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. To discuss the inquiry and other issues in Indigenous affairs, we're joined by Professor Tom Calmer, who's Chancellor of the University of Canberra. Professor Calmer is also co-chair of Reconciliation Australia and a former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. Professor Calmer is an Aboriginal elder whose traditional lands are southwest of Darwin and on the Cobourg Peninsula, so he's very familiar with the Northern Territory and its issues. Tom Calmer, what's your general view of how the federal government has handled the revelations of abuse in the NT correction system?
Well, I think firstly we can say that when it was originally raised in numerous reports leading up until the Four Corners event, there was very little to no interest by the federal government, and particularly by the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, and it was pretty much swept under the carpet at the Northern Territory level. So since the airing of the Four Corners program, we've seen, some fairly swift reaction from the Prime Minister. I should say that the Prime Minister Turnbull wasn't in the chair at the time of the original airings, so he has taken swift action, which on the one hand should be recognised, but on the other hand, sometimes it's better to not proceed too quickly without giving due consideration to a whole range of issues, and I think that's what may have occurred on this occasion, but I think we're now getting back on track.
You mentioned that the federal government and the NT government didn't take any notice of the revelations that had come out in earlier reports. But one of the new commissioners, Mick Gooder, has been the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. Why didn't the Human Rights Commission, of which he's part, pick up on these things?
Well, I believe that he has continually raised it. We have not that specific issue, but, there's a strong cohort of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peak bodies who have been advocating for the government to include justice targets in their COAG targets and to address all the issues that were up there. And so this is not the first time this has been raised. It's been an ongoing concern. But I guess the real revelation has been the extent of the totality of what was displayed on the Four Corners program, which instead of just having small snippets in the past and relating them back to a riot within the prison, it's now been revealed that you could not say that it was a riot as such, and that this seems to be very systemically entrenched behaviours.
It's also a testament to the power of pictures, isn't it?
Well, I think so, and even though some of the pictures were displayed previously, and I must say that it did create concern when they were first aired, but then the way it was presented by the media in support of, or not presented by the media, which lent support to the government's position, the Northern Territory government's position, that everything was in hand and it was just a one-off anomaly. But we've now seen through the Four Corners program that it was, in fact, and has been an ongoing issue, not only in the Don Dale Centre in Darwin, but in the Youth Detention Centre down in Alice Springs as well.
Given that this is all about the Northern Territory government's behaviour, is it really appropriate that that government is co-sponsor of this Royal Commission?
Well, you know, I would think not. You don't get, you don't get the opportunity to have an independent Royal Commission very often, and to have one where one of the major defendants is going to have to be the Northern Territory government. In all consciousness, they should just withdraw from the process and leave it up to the independent commissioners to do, because, it could be perceived as being, too close and perceived to be precisely what they accused, former Chief Justice Martin as being, involved in the process, and therefore couldn't take an independent position.
Another criticism that's been made of the Commission is that it's not broad enough, that in fact it should take in what's happening in the states. Do you share that view, or do you think it's better to keep it narrowly focused?
Well, very much so. We've seen, initially the reaction was very concerning when it was restricted to the Don Dale Centre, but I believe it's been extended now to all Northern Territory detention centres, or at least that's what the commissioners might be trying to promote. Since this revelation has taken place amongst the chatter from Indigenous people particularly, there's concerns that this sort of behaviour takes place across the nation and therefore it should be broader. I think one of the... If it was a Royal Commission was to go broader at this very first very time, then we'd have to spend a lot more time developing up the terms of reference and selecting the right sort of team to be able to run it. And it could include Mick Gooder and Justice White, but there's probably others who could also contribute if it was much broader. But being a focus on the territory, I think the two Royal Commissioners are adequately skilled and qualified to take on this role. What's been pleasing to hear, and I heard Gillian Triggs, the head of the Australian Human Rights Commission, say this morning that each of the states and territories have now been asked to present to the federal government a report on what's happening in relation to youth detention in their respective states and territories. That's very welcomed, but what would be most important to see is what the terms of reference are, and specifically what they will be reporting on and what sort of timeframes, and whether there will be any independent scrutiny in getting that data out. And it's, it would not be, untowards to ensure that with each of the state and territory governments that they appoint somebody who is seen to be independent to work with them in compiling the report on what's happening in the justice area. And that could very much include, any number of very skilled and qualified Indigenous lawyers and barristers out there who could spend a bit of time in scrutinising those reports and working with the state and territories to compile the reports back to the federal government on what's happening in youth detention in their states. And why I say it's important to look at the terms of reference of this broader inquiry or reporting process is that, we don't want to just limit it to people who may be charged and then detained. When we see in the Northern Territory and in other states and territories, there are many of those incarcerated who are on remand, and we want to know how long they've been on remand and why they're incarcerated if they're only on remand.
What we're seeing in the detention system, though, points to the much wider problem of why so many young Indigenous people are getting there in the first place. Mm. And this goes back to the nature of communities, broken communities, problems of drugs, of drink, of unemployment, housing, all these sorts of things. Yes. How can this in fact be tackled? This has been talked about for decades in a very serious way, but only limited progress seems to be being made.
Mm. Yeah, it's been very limited progress, and I think this is, you've hit on what is a real big concern, and that is why are people being incarcerated? There's no end of reports that have been done that identify this as an issue, from the Law Reform Commission to other state and territory coroners' reports that allude to this fact. And, you know, government reports and reports that the government has, in fact, requested be done. And I continually refer to the Strategic Review on Indigenous Expenditure of 2010, carried out by Dr. Neil Johnson. And at the time was a Deputy Secretary, I believe, in the government. And that was a report to the Department of Finance. Well, for the first period of time, that report was not released to the public, and it was only through a Freedom of Information request that it was released. And that was a fairly damning report, not on Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, but on the bureaucracy itself. And in essence, it sent a clear message back to governments that a lot of the issues that affect Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people are actually the result of government policies and programs both being delivered and not being delivered, and too much top-down imposition on communities, and not enough working with the communities to develop up the solutions. The Productivity Commission, I think in about 2012, had similar findings, and that was a report to government. The Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner reports continually. You can go back to the very first reports that talk about these issues. And remember that the Social Justice Commissioner position was established as a direct outcome of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, where it was recognised then that there was no independent source of advice being provided to government about what's happening in Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander affairs, and particularly how human rights treaties and covenants and so forth were being applied in relation to Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people. So from the time of its establishment till now, each year the Social Justice Commissioner produces a report to the Parliament of Australia. It's a legislative requirement, and the Parliament receives it, and then too often it just gets shelved, and the recommendations aren't seriously considered. So that's another area that we have to push. If we look at the 2009 Social Justice Report, one of my last reports, I wrote in that about a program that I had seen in the United States that had a potential application here, and that was about justice reinvestment. And that, in essence, is really about taking money that would be spent on incarcerating people and redirecting that back into the community to develop programs that would stop and assist people to not offend. Because when we look at the reason, and this is across the board why people offend, it's because of addictions to various substances. It's about property issues. It's about driving without licenses, not about breaching community service orders. A lot of them could be seen as not really crimes against a person, except for assaults, which are pretty high with Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people. But when we look at all of those issues and the reasons for crime, many of them are related to poverty or lack of opportunity, and many are related to the lack of treatment services for addictions and so forth, but also treatment services for people who might have a mental health issue, particularly the intergenerational traumas that Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people experience. And so, that was a model. Since then, we've had a Senate inquiry that went out. It was a joint inquiry, and that's now reported back to the Parliament. That's now sitting on the bookshelf. We've seen another Senate report looking at the social determinants of health, which are all those things that affect our health, and it's the same determinants that impact on incarceration, like employment, education, housing, mental health, all of them. That's been done, it's been tabled in parliaments, it's now sitting on a bookshelf. These are the sort of reports that governments had the advice from the experts, even their own internal experts, and they still don't take notice of them. And that's what hopefully something like the Royal Commission or another former commission will expose. But with all of them, And particularly when we look at the 339 recommendations of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, where the majority of those were never ever taken up. We can't have another Royal Commission where the recommendations are just shelved again and no activity. You know, a government who is working for the people, you know, will be responsible and seriously consider the recommendations of these reports and implement them.
Often individuals make a difference. Do you think that we need a more dynamic federal minister in this area? And do you think we need some more dynamic leadership in the Indigenous community?
I think, you know, in the first one, if I look at the Indigenous leadership, there is very strong leadership in the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander community. If we look at, for example, the Close the Gap Steering Committee, a body of Indigenous and non-Indigenous health peak bodies who was established in March 2006. They've been meeting every quarter since then. We've just celebrated 10 years since our establishment. We don't get government funding. They're all the peak bodies working on Indigenous health. We're an advocacy group. We provide advice to government continually, but that advice goes nowhere. You know, very, very often, it's not accepted. And so then that goes back to the question, well, what is the role of the Health Minister and the Minister for Indigenous Affairs in taking notice of the various reports, including, you know, the Social Justice Commissioner reports and the Close the Gap reports, and where do they go? Well, we've seen some advancements in a bipartisan approach to health, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, where Labor developed the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health plan, and under the coalition led by Senator Fiona Nash, she then developed an implementation plan. But that process has always and has always been led by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So if you've got a minister who is interested, who wants to give the authority to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to take the lead, it can work. And that is really the model that we should be looking at. Then you look at the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, and his interest in Indigenous affairs has really got to be questioned, and why he doesn't take note of the various reports that are out there, why he limits his consultation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to a small handful of people who aren't representative, when we have the National Congress of Australia's First People, a nationally elected body out there of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that has an ethics council established that looks at all of its policies. It has gender equality, so 50% of our membership are men and 50% women. That's mandatory across the whole membership of the executive and governance. You know, so it's the most credible body that exists out there to provide advice to governments. And we're willing and we continually press the issue of collaboration and partnership. From an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspective, our hand is extended to government. It's not being embraced, and that's what's got to change. And if that means we've got to change ministers to somebody who's going to be much more responsive, who's not going to have an attitude that consultation is about telling people what the government wants to achieve, then, and only until we can get somebody who's going to be responsive, then we can say that the current minister, really is not doing a good enough job.
Have you any ideas, names in mind? Tony Abbott, perhaps?
No. Well, look, I would not suggest, Tony Abbott as the Minister for Indigenous Affairs. He has an interest, but, he's demonstrated on too many occasions a lack of capacity to hear what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have to say, and he looks at a very small and limited number of Aboriginal people who he does embrace, and that's not good enough. You know, we from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leadership sector, and that's all the peak bodies that are out there, are interested in advancing, equality for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We're not into party politics. We're into encouraging partnership and collaboration and bipartisanship approaches and long-term plans. And you can see that through what we've promoted through the Close the Gap campaign, which then permeates across most of what happens in Indigenous affairs, where it's about, you know, a very disciplined approach of wanting to work together, to achieve equality within a generation. So, you know, ministers who have their own agendas, you know, it's just not good enough. When I talk about Minister Scullion, and it's, you know, personally, you know, I know him, and you know, it disappoints me all the time when he says things like, you know, because the National Congress of Australia's First People only has 8,000 or 9,000 members, that it's not a representative body. When, if you look on a per population basis, our membership of 8,000 or 9,000 plus 180 national peak bodies and organisations we represent has a phenomenal membership, and it's in fact far greater than the combined party membership of the Liberal Party and the National Party put together on a proportional basis. So, you know, and in fact it's a larger per population proportional membership base than even the Labor Party. So anybody who wants to suggest that, you know, the National Congress of Australia's First People is not representative is very much out of touch of understanding.
Now, you mentioned the Closing the Gap program. There's been a lot of resistance by the coalition to including a justice target in that program. It covers health, education, employment and so on. Do you think a justice target would be desirable?
I think it's very, very desirable, and I should just clarify that the Close the Gap campaign is the people's movement that's very much based on a human rights-based approach. Closing the Gap is the government's response, and that is not human rights-based, and it's very selective as to what they do. One of the things that you know, has been really promoted, or a couple of things, in relation to targets, is that there firstly should be mental health targets, and that was a recommendation from the National Mental Health Commission. I think it was a 2012 national report to government recommending that we have targets on mental health. And the recommendation for justice targets, and there must be a number of targets, not just a single target, because there's many aspects to justice that we need to look at, has been promoted, it's been advanced to government, but they haven't embraced it.
Just turning to another issue in Indigenous affairs, at the moment there's increasing talk, I think, among Indigenous leaders and from Bill Shorten, that the move for the constitutional recognition of First Australians won't be adequate if it's not accompanied by other things, and we're seeing discussion of whether this should be some treaty process. Do you think we need that sort of process as part of this recognition movement, or would that just imperil the chances of a referendum getting through? What's your opinion there?
Well, I think, you know, in relation to opinion, and it's a little bit advised from, you know, as co-chair of Reconciliation Australia, but also the various groups that we meet with and who advise us. The first thing is you know, the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as First Peoples in the Constitution can and should go ahead. Other reforms to the Constitution are a bit more complex, and that's in relation to what they call the racist clauses of the Constitution. Some are contentious, some are not, but that's a second story. But the constitutional reform can proceed and not impinge on any movement to develop a treaty, and vice versa. They're two separate but parallel processes going along. And, you know, I'd urge everybody to become informed about these issues. I think that there is a need for some sort of a treaty, but, you know, it's very interesting when you ask people what do they mean by treaty, to see what sort of response we get. Even the bodies who are, you know, advocating for a treaty aren't quite specific about what sort of treaty. If we look at what's happened already, and the broader definition of a treaty is between an agreement between two sovereign nations, and the sovereign nation is Australia, and the second sovereign nation are those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as collectives who have got you know, ownership over land, and about 20% of the Australian land mass is owned or controlled. When we look at controlled, it could be as high as nearly 40% of the land mass is controlled by Aboriginal people, but it's only the bits that have been owned and determined to be granted to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as sovereign nations that we can negotiate. And so, you know, that's important to recognise, if we look at that sort of definition, that there are multiple treaties already existing in Australia. And one of the probably the big ones in more recent times that's got a bit of airplay, but it hasn't been called a treaty, is the agreement that's been developed between the West Australian government and the Noongar Nation in West Australia, where there has been agreements and between those two sovereign nations to land settlements, to compensation and access to property. So in real terms, that is a treaty. And that's existed in West Australia, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people aren't recognised in the state constitution, although there are now moves afoot to recognise. The West Australian government's going to do that, is to recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But in most other states, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been recognised in the state constitutions. The second important one is in Victoria, where there is a big treaty movement, and the Victorian government, who have for many years now recognised Aboriginal people in their constitution, are now going through a process of trying to develop up a treaty with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We're not sure what form that'll take. But then if we look at the broader notion of a treaty, and others are saying about a treaty for the whole of Australia, well, what that looks like, that's anybody's guess. And who the treaty is negotiated with in relation to the 700,000 Aboriginal people in Australia is another issue, particularly if we've got a situation where the government is not recognising the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, and it might be the case that that won't be the person who develops a treaty. But when we look at treaties in other jurisdictions around the world, New Zealand, the treaty was struck between the Maori people and the New Zealand government in 1840. But that was with a singular group, because Maoris are only one group across that whole country of New Zealand. When you look at treaties in the United States, they're between the tribal groups. The Navajo have got a treaty. The various other groups around, from Mohawks and so forth, there's many treaties over there, but they're between the owners of a designated land mass, or a tribal group, we should say in our terms here, and the government. So, the discussions about treaty, I think, have got some way to go to try and understand and get everybody to get on a common platform to understand what a treaty is about.
Just finally, I noticed that you were one of the Indigenous leaders who signed a statement the other day saying that Kevin Rudd should have been nominated for the UN job. Why do you think that?
Well, from a personal level, I signed off on it because it was Kevin Rudd who led the Australian government into and all governments through the COAG process to recognising the Close the Gap and the Closing the Gap response way back in November 2007. He then struck the agreement with us through the Statement of Intent. I was actively involved with Prime Minister Rudd at the time and Jenny Macklin in looking at the National Apology, and I gave the formal response on behalf of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Well, the Stolen Generations at least asked me to give the final the response on their behalf to that process. I was involved with both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard in our movement in Australia to get recognised as a seat on the UN Security Council, and participated in quite a number of the meetings that they had and functions for visiting dignitaries in that process. And I think the other thing is that even though they're domestic, some are domestic, some are international, we've got to be able to separate our domestic attitude towards an individual to what their value is internationally. And, you know, there's a number of diplomats that have now got key postings who one might have thought, you know, domestically we didn't like them, but internationally they're doing a job. And so that's the separation. And that's the level of support that I think, helped convince me to lend my support to calling for him, or to recognising that maybe he should have been at least receiving the nomination from Australia. But it's a long way to go from being nominated to the whole process of international lobbying to then get appointed. So, yeah.
Tom Kelmer, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back again soon.